here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 30th of January. I'm Jennifer Schwimmer.
And I'm Alberta Montilia. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is currently 5:18 and time for a full 45 minutes of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are a radio essay by Josh Gabert-Doyon, and the Greek elections, global austerity, and its local significance.
We also have a report by Sahar Asaf about social activist Loujain Hatoul, who was detained for driving as a woman in Saudi Arabia. Sahar spoke with Faisal Al-Alami about Saudi Arabian law and fatwas against female drivers.
Later in the program, Kosta Protanovich speaks with the members of the UBC Bitcoin Club and their upcoming initiatives and the utility of Bitcoin for students.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, I am a UBC student. And UBC's AMS team up for a second protest against tuition and residence fees increases. Late last semester, UBC's administration approved a 10% increase to international tuition and 20% increase for 8-month housing contracts. Students were shrewd that the university would increase fees without warning or consulting students, mobilized to protest to the announcement. The I Am a Student movement was formed, a collection of concerned students and social justice organizations. Thursday afternoon, dozens of demonstrators marched across campus in a second protest against the hikes, waving signs and chanting their slogans. Demonstrators marched to President Arvind Gupta's office, where they sat in front of a building to show their discontent. On Twitter, members of I Am a Student voiced their concerns, writing, quote, "If you think $2,000 is inconsequential, can you give me $2,000? End quote. Protesters also invited President Gupta to their demonstration for pizza. Gupta did not comment on the demonstration or the invitation for pizza.
In local news, plans for updated sewage treatment in Victoria, BC are delayed. Capital of British Columbia, Victoria, is one of the last major cities north of San Diego to dump untreated waste, including pesticides, street runoff, and pharmaceuticals, into the ocean. Every day, 130 liters of raw sewage is pumped out of the Juan de Fuca Strait. Last Friday, the sewer screening system failed, and 3 million extra liters of unfiltered waste spilt into the Ross Bay. According to scientists tasked with monitoring Victoria's sewer situation, bacteria tests routinely exceeded water quality guidelines, and the problem only seems to be getting worse as time goes on. As Esquimalt's McClay Point, for example, the lower water column counts of fecal chloroform, which is a group of bacteria that can carry illness-causing pathogens like E. coli and neurovirus, exceeded guidelines 11% of the time in 2011. By 2013, tests exceeded the bacteria guidelines 75% of the time. Lisa Helps, newly elected mayor of Victoria, says she understands the gravity of the situation, quoting, "I want to take action on this, but I want to make sure the action we take has long-term, high-quality impacts." Mayor Helps says the city can do better, putting the waste to work in treatment plants, creating useful fuel and heat, as many other cities already do. One of the technologies being touted in gasification, a process of breaking down waste with gas that the mayor is confident will work as intended. With her constituents at risk, Esquimalt's mayor, Barb DeHardin, supports the pilot plant plan. She says Esquimalt is aiming to finish the first stage of its consultation process by the end of January and have, quote, some kind of concept for the community by March. Meanwhile, incidents like the failure of Victoria's sewer screening system will continue, and southern BC waters will continue to be contaminated.
Judge rejects Mountain's bid to have perjury charge dismissed. A BC's judge has refused to dismiss a perjury charge against an RCMP constable. The constable, Jerry Rundle, stands accused of lying about an incident in 2007 when a Polish immigrant passed away after being hit with a taser at Vancouver International Airport. Constable Rundle was one of the four RCMP officers involved in the confrontation of Rob Gigantsi that resulted in his death. A public inquiry was held in 2009, during which time the four officers presented their notes and testimonies. A video of the encounter that aired on CBC was also entered as evidence. The Crown substantially brought charges against all four officers, alleging that they had collectively fabricated a story for investigators and lied at the inquiry. The Crown has argued that there were discrepancies in Rundell's statements, particularly in describing how Gigantsky threatened the officers with a stapler. Crown lawyers presented evidence relating to six particular instances of factual inconsistency, which they say proves their case. Rundell's lawyer disputed the claim, arguing prosecutors' evidence was too flimsy to support a conviction. BC Supreme Court Judge Miriam Gropper upheld the perjury charge, saying, quote, I have found that there is some evidence in respect of each alleged lie that a reasonable jury, properly instructed, can convict, end quote. The altercation between the RCMP and Gigantsky began 10 hours after the 40-year-old man arrived from Poland and was forced to remain in the airport, when he became agitated and began throwing furniture. The victim's mother, Sofia Czakowski, has said that she was still waiting for closure on this tragedy that has consumed her life for the past 7 years. Rundell is the final officer to be tried on the perjury charge, with Constable Bentley acquitted, former Corporal Robinson awaiting verdict, and Constable Millington in the midst of his trial. The Crown has stated it will be appealing the acquittal of Corporal Bentley and hopes to have all four officers convicted of perjury.
In national news, refugee healthcare fight costs feds $1.4 million. The federal government's legal battle over the Interim Refuge Health Program has now exceeded $1.4 million in costs. Last December, Toronto NDP MP Andrew Cash filed a request for the total amount spent on legal fees and costs to date. So far, his request for the exact cost has been denied by the federal government. Justice Minister Peter McKay has stated, quote, it is not possible to define these costs with any degree of accuracy. Releasing an estimated cost of $1,431,148. MP Cash has called the government to drop its appeals and to restore the benefits to the refugees. In an email to CBC, Cash wrote, instead of paying lawyers to keep health care away from refugees, the Conservatives should end this offensive charade, abide by the federal court's rulings, and fully restore the program. Kevin Menard, a spokesman for the immigration minister, said restoring benefits would cost the government $4 million to implement, arguing that they are defending the interests of Canadian taxpayers. In 2012, the Conservative government decided to repeal health care for people waiting to find out if their refugee claim would be accepted. In its place, the government began allocating health coverage based on claimants' countries of origin and further restricted the coverage to emergency cases only. As a result, Clements lost access to coverage for pharmaceuticals, vision, and dental care. This system was challenged by refugee Clements and doctors last July, and the federal court ruled that these refugee Clements, while not yet technically admitted as refugees in Canada, still had the right to access health care services. Federal Court Justice Anne McTavish declared the system would be cruel and unusual and gave the government 4 months to institute a solution. The Conservatives' response was a temporary plan to extend coverage for children and pregnant women and to remove classifications based on country. However, coverage is still tiered dependent on the progress of a person's refugee claim, and pharmaceutical coverage remains completely restricted. Ritika Goel, a Toronto family doctor and member of the advocacy group Health for All, is concerned that refugee claimants will not receive care, even with the temporary plan. She states, I think many providers don't understand the details of what has happened, and therefore likely to continue to turn people away, adding that there is no system to inform providers who is covered for what. The federal court's pro-climate ruling is not where the story ends. The federal government is appealing the ruling, and no court date has been set.
Gender Identity to Guide Housing of Ontario's transgender inmates, and Ontario transgender inmates will now be treated based on their own gender identity rather than their physical sex. Previously, inmates were placed in their institutions based on their, quote, primary sexual characteristics, but will now be housed according to their self-identified gender, chosen name, and preferred pronoun. Correctional Services Minister Yasif Nakhvi said that of the change that, quote, this is the most progressive policy on the treatment of trans inmates in North America, end quote. The policy builds on interim guidelines that were put in place last April. The case of Avery Edison, a trans woman from England, who was detained by the Canadian Border Services Agency last February, raised public attention on the mistreatment of transgender individuals by law enforcement. Avery was initially detained in a men's facility, despite her passport identifying her as female, but was eventually transferred to a women's facility. Her human rights case is ongoing. Nakhvi said of the new policy, it is about ensuring that trans inmates are given the same protections, same dignity, and the same treatment. It is about respect and dignity for gender identity and gender expression.
In international news, militants attack hotel in Tripoli, remain active in Libya. On Wednesday, gunmen stormed the Corinthia Hotel in Tripoli, opening fire as a car bomb exploded near the reception area. Security forces were quick to respond, but at least 9 people were killed in the attack. According to other sources, 5 of the 9 victims were foreign nationals. The Twitter account affiliated with the Islamic State militant group has claimed responsibility, claiming that the attack was retribution for the death of Abu Anas al-Libi, a Libyan jihadist who passed away in January. Sources believe the Corinthia Hotel was specifically targeted as a hub for foreign nationals and businesses, and because it was housing Omar al-Hassi, the prime minister of Tripoli's government. Officials say the victims include citizens from the U.S. and France, one of which was a military contractor. The attack is the latest in a string of violence in western Libya, including abductions and bombings that have been claimed by the Islamic State. While the IS has claimed responsibility for these attacks, it remains unclear whether the perpetrators were IS militants or merely inspired by them.
Vice News debuts first ever virtual reality news program. Vice News has teamed up with digital artist Chris Milk and filmmaker Spike Jones for the first ever virtual reality tour news broadcast of December Millions March protest rally in New York. The feature was recently unveiled at the Sundance Film Festival, where viewers were provided with a wraparound-style headsets. The film was shot using a 360-degree camera system, which followed Vice News correspondent Alice Berry through the march. The broadcast will allow viewers to experience the protest rally as though they were actually there. The app will be available through Apple iTunes and Google Play, and viewers can watch the film using the most smartphones or Google's cardboard virtual reality headset. Vice News says that the film will eventually be available for other headsets, including Facebook-owned Oculus Rift. Spike Jones, who is creative director of Vice News, said, quote, living in New York this fall and feeling the spontaneous protests against police brutality that have been growing, forming, and growing, it seemed like this is the most timely and important subject to shoot, end quote. Chris Milk is planning to work with Vice News on more VR journalism projects and said, quote, my hope is that VR is the tool that we need to stir more compassion for one another. I think VR holds the potential to fundamentally challenge journalism. End quote. The demonstration was attended by more than 25,000 New Yorkers who were called for nationwide reform after the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
For over 30 years, Discorder has been bringing Vancouver local independent music journalism. And a place to work! I'm Brenda Corlett! If you're a fan, check out the Discorder readership survey on our site at discorder.ca. You could have a chance to win gift certificates to the Rickshaw, the Lido, and Vinyl Records.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have a radio essay by Josh Gabert-Doyon on the Greek elections, global austerity, and its local significance.
January 26th, red flags line the street of Athens. Alexis Tsipras of the Greek Coalition of the Radical Left is sworn in as Prime Minister. The Anti-Capitalist Party, which goes by the acronym Syriza in Greek, has just won the election. While having the most seats in Parliament, Syriza fell short of an absolute majority and formed a coalition government with a minor right-wing party. The two parties, as you might expect, have little in common, except for their strong stance against austerity measures placed on Greece in exchange for a bailout. The victory of the new anti-austerity coalition has sent reverberations across the European Union. The story of the Greek economic crisis goes something like this. Around 2010, global economic downturn, a major debt crisis in Europe, and domestic fiscal catastrophe culminated in Greece. Its economy was downgraded to the infamous junk bond status, meaning that the economy risked failing. Then came the Troika. The Eurozone countries, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, together bailing out Greece in May of 2010, and then again in 2014. The bailout programs came at a cost. The Troika alone was conditional on a severe program of austerity that Greece would have to implement. Massive spending cuts within the government tore at the social fabric. Cuts in the healthcare system, public sector layoffs, education spending disinvestment, and reductions in social programs for the most vulnerable. It was common sense neoliberalism. After all, if you're in debt, you need to stop spending. The results were brutal. High unemployment, poverty, homelessness, increasing rates of diseases like HIV, drug use, depression, and suicide. There have been general strikes and riots opposing these cuts, and the political situation has been erratic. 5 leaders in 6 years, the old guard struggling for power while new radical parties emerged. Golden Dawn, the most controversial of these parties, has sustained itself on a platform of anti-immigration, nationalism, and extreme right-wing politics. The common narrative in North America is that Greece had it coming. That commonplace tax evasion, corruption, and reckless spending are the source of Greece's woes. There's some truth to this. Greece was running a deficit, but most countries are. And it's difficult to deny that tax evasion and corruption weren't an issue in Greece, particularly within the government and the wealthy class. But while these causes have taken center stage, they serve to justify the ideologically charged and disciplinary policy of austerity. The Greek people have responded and elected a party which is determined to renegotiate the conditions of their 240 billion euro bailout. Syriza has called the Greek bailout plan a humanitarian disaster. It's promised emergency measures, with plans to increase the minimum wage in Greece, pension payouts for the least fortunate, and the distribution of food and electricity coupons to households. Universal healthcare is also a major policy point. Most importantly, it's looking to dispute the austerity measures put in place by the Troika. But the truth of the matter is that a common-sense rhetoric behind the Troika's measures aren't confined to Europe. The International Monetary Fund has a tendency to place similar conditions on developing countries in the global south. Meanwhile in Canada, it's the same ideological foundation which has led to government spending cuts on the federal and provincial level. Cuts to programs like Canada Post and the CBC, along with widespread disinvestment in education. There has been opposition. Last November, tens of thousands marched in Montreal against austerity. In British Columbia, teachers went on strike when a deal couldn't be reached between the provincial government and the union. Again, decisions made by the provincial government about where to place value and where to cut spending. And austerity is about that equation, not about the necessary conditions to fight economic downturn. It's perhaps too easy to write off what's happening in Greece as a distant foreign crisis, something played out in dark meeting rooms and apocalyptic riotscapes. In October, UBC announced that it would be increasing tuition funds for international students by 10% and housing fees by 20%. As a public institution, UBC is receiving its money from the provincial government, who in turn is receiving payments from the federal government. Cuts in government spending on education are being passed on, and ultimately, the burden is being placed on students. The bulk of the criticism against these hikes has been placed on the university, and that's probably justified. Responsibility cannot be taken off the university completely, for at the end of the day, they're the ones who are making the decisions. What we risk losing, though, in framing the discussion as an issue of money management, of too many office supplies or exaggerated professor salaries, is the fact that we are a part of the neoliberal paradigm. We are victims of neoliberal fiscal policy, subject to its whims and staunch common sense. If Syriza's victory tells us anything, it might be that a change is coming.
Thank you, Josh. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Hi there. Are you tired of listening to the same music day in and day out and want to try something a little different? Well then, how about listening to Asian music? Now, I don't mean it like
Oppan Gangnam Style!
Nor like
G-Bass! G-Bass! Oh, baby, but she moves, she moves.
I'm talking about a little more like... And a little more like... And also a little more like... And definitely something like... So tune in to Asian Wave 101, playing you the best of Chinese and Korean pop, Wednesdays from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m., only on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have a report by Sahir Asaf about social activist Lujain Hathoul, who was detained for driving as a woman in Saudi Arabia. Sahir spoke with Fasil Al-Alami about Saudi Arabian law and fatwas against female drivers.
On the 30th of November, 2014, political activist and former UBC student Lujain Al-Hathoul set out to defy Saudi Arabia's ban on women driving. Lujain tried to cross into Saudi Arabia's border from the neighboring United Arab Emirates with a UAE driver's license. When she arrived at the border, she demanded to be let through. Lujain was ordered to park her car and wait overnight. UAE-based journalist Mesa Al-Moody took to the road the next day to deliver food, water, and a blanket after Lujain live-tweeted, quote, I have been at the Saudi border for 24 hours. They don't want to give me my passport, nor will they let me pass, unquote. Lujain and Mesa were ordered to drive their cars across the UAE border and into Saudi Arabia. They were arrested as soon as they entered. Both women have been detained since then and have been referred to a special criminal court. Saudi Arabia has no written law prohibiting women from driving, only fatwas, also known as religious edicts by senior clerics. Women must rely on male relatives to drive them to work, school, or the doctor, unless they can afford to hire a driver. Last year, King Abdullah's advisory council reportedly recommended women over 30 years old to be allowed to drive. I spoke to Faisal Al-Alami, a graduate student at the Department of Classical Near Eastern and Religious Studies and a student at UBC Law, to explain the laws and fatwas on women driving in Saudi Arabia.
Tell us why women are prohibited from driving in Saudi Arabia. So how did it come to be this way?
Because of the complexity of this particular issue, there is no straightforward answer. There is no actual written law that bans women from driving in the kingdom. There are fatwas, and those are what we in religious studies call non-binding legal opinions issued by grand muftis or people in high religious authority that prohibits women from driving. But there is no systematized law that actually prohibits women from driving. It just happens to be frowned upon or something that is not accepted.
That's really interesting that it's because of a fatwa, so it's embedded in deeply held religious beliefs, mm-hmm. And not like an actual law that prevents women from driving. So what's the reason provided by Saudi clerics as to why women shouldn't drive?
Some fatwas are adhered to by the government, while others are completely ignored. But with this particular fatwa, the mufti uses a particular justification known as stopping the means. So driving is seen as a means to other more prohibited things like illicit sex or sex before marriage. So if a woman would potentially have access to a vehicle and she was able to drive herself, then she might be able to drive herself to situations that are un-Islamic. So the end of the driving, the end result would be due to the driving.
So tell me how you know Lu Jane.
Well, I used to work at the Saudi Arabian Student Association. I was a co-founder of that organization, along with a few friends. And Lu Jane at the time was the president of the Arab Student Association here at UBC. So we had certain functions, and we you know, met, and we discussed certain issues. We didn't talk about women driving, unfortunately, but she was very outspoken in her views and her opinions. She led a fantastic student group. And that's just reflective of her personality and her nature as a great leader.
Yeah, Lu Jane was very involved on campus. Like, I met her 4 years ago in my first year, and she was an avid member of the Pakistani Students Association, yeah. So I met her at a bunch of events that were held by PSA. So this is the first time that female drivers have been referred to a specialized criminal court in Riyadh. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of this?
There's no straightforward answer. One opinion that a colleague of mine mentioned was the power of discourse. If we look at this situation as an outside observer, not cultivating any form of bias, this whole idea of a terrorism court is a manifestation of Western media. This is one argument. The other argument is she's being tried in a terrorism court in order to make a statement, or to make her a symbol of the consequences of driving. This is what would happen if you drive. You will be tried in a terrorism court and potentially face some severe charges and prosecutions. But at the end of the day, we really don't know what's going on. Is she actually being tried in a terrorism court? It doesn't really matter. The point is she being tried for something that was legally within her right to do?
Do you worry that this case might have a chilling effect for other women who might want to campaign against the ban in the future?
Well, I suspect that the proponents repealing this ban, or wanting to repeal this ban, would lay dormant for a little bit, given the sensitivity of this current issue. But I wouldn't really say that it sets a precedent for future movements. At the end of the day, the movement still exists. These are two individuals who are caught in a terrible strain of events, in a terrible crossfire, I believe, or it really is an anomaly, right? There is no other way of explaining it. But so long as the movement lives on, I think we might see a potential of reform in the future. But this question in particular addresses a key issue here. How are you going to go about in repealing the ban without causing more harm than good? This is something that I encourage the proponents of the October 26th movement to consider. They did a great job at getting behind the wheel on October 26th with no arrest being made. And this is a situation, the most current situation, is someone who drove into the border and unfortunately got arrested, even though they were allegedly within their right.
What do you mean by causing more harm?
So when I say harm, I mean harm to the movement. I wouldn't say that Lu Jane and Maysa deliberately or intended to cause harm to the movement. No, they came in with really good intent. They came in to spread a message. As a matter of fact, there were reports saying that Lu Jane thought this through before driving to the border in order to spread a message. That one of the excuses that you're giving us is that women are not allowed to obtain driver's license in the kingdom. But I can go to a GCC state and get a driver's license that's applicable in all GCC states. So within my right, I'm entitled to drive. And that was the statement she made, and I thought it was a very brave statement. But unfortunately, it affected her, I believe, negatively, and it might have impacted the movement.
Do you think this ban gaining a lot of international attention, does it help the cause or does it harm the issue?
The downside of Western intervention would be that this movement would not be recognized as a purely Saudi manifestation, but something that was highly influenced by the West. That's one side. The other side would be that Western influence would really help pressure the Saudis to alleviate this restriction. But you know, again, it's these are just hypotheticals. You can't really come up with a straightforward answer. If the Saudis did it on their own, this is something that could signify a great step towards a better future for men and women.
Thanks so much, Faisal. Just like Faisal, I had the honor of meeting Lou Jane 4 years ago when she was a UBC student in her third year majoring in French literature. Lou Jane was here as part of a Saudi government initiative to educate the next generation by sponsoring their post-secondary studies in Canada and the United States. There are approximately 20,000 Saudi students in Canada completing their post-secondary education and another 90,000 in the United States. After her university education, Lou Jane directed her efforts towards political activism by pushing barriers for change in Saudi Arabia. She has over 200,000 Twitter followers and became a supporter of a grassroots campaign launched last year to oppose the ban on women driving. Today, Lou Jane and Mesa have been imprisoned for almost 2 months. Their arrest marks the longest and most restrictive sanction on women driving. We're still waiting to find out what will happen if they will be released and find more clarity on the current situation. We will continue to cover Lou Jane and Mesa's story here at CITR News 101.
Thank you, Sahir. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Do you like laughing, hilarity, radical thought-provoking creativity, and laughing? UBC Improv is UBC's home for improvisational comedy, theater made up on the spot. Like us on Facebook to learn when our next shows are. Search for us on YouTube for our film sketches. And follow us on Twitter because we want the followers. UBC Improv. Insert cheesy slogan here. Let's get it on. It's your
club. Let's get it on.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have Kosta Pradanovic, who spoke with members from the UBC Bitcoin Club about their upcoming initiatives and the utility of Bitcoin for students.
UBC Bitcoin Club is a new organization on campus trying to get students involved in the rapidly expanding world of cryptocurrency. I spoke with Wilson Cross and Ben Tedamonte about the new initiative. Seeing as Bitcoin is a bit of a confusing concept for a lot of people, could you maybe explain a little bit about how the currency works?
Yeah, for sure. So it's an open digital currency, digital finance. It's really taken on that mold. It's a peer-to-peer transaction, so there's no intermediary, and it won't be centralized by any banks, so it's totally decentralized. Peer-to-peer meaning, again, no middleman. It's person-to-person over the technology, which is, you know, taking mold of blockchain technology. Other than that, I mean, it does get more complex, but you can buy, sell bitcoins just like any other real money, or the Canadian dollar, the American dollar. I believe right now one bitcoin is worth $291. I checked this morning. It is quite volatile, which does, you know, stem into kind of a social stigma about whether it's viable for an actual currency in the future. But other than that,
is that perhaps because it's such a young currency?
Yeah, very young. We had a great event the other night, and one of our speakers, Manny Eager, he was talking about how it's not even at the 1.0 stage. So it's, you know, it was founded in 2008, 2009. So obviously there's so much room for innovation and growth within it. But yeah.
Very exciting. So I want to ask a little bit about the UBC Bitcoin Club. Where did the idea for the club come from?
Really, I got into it just as Ben got into it, I think. It's just kind of investor stage and kind of overall interest. I had a good friend at Penn State University, and I heard about people doing it at MIT University, is bringing a club to the university. And it wasn't necessarily the idea of bringing a club. It was just telling your friends at a kind of a larger scale and educating the student body. So then, I mean, in the fall, late summer, I talked to AMS, and then it got done, and a lot of people have latched on.
And Ben, how did you get involved?
Similar way. I just kind of read about it online, probably 2012, 2011, and just tried to catch on to it. Ended up investing a little bit and just playing around. This is back before the big run-up, and you don't really know who's into it, who isn't. And then one day, talked to Will, and Will said, "Yeah, I'm into Bitcoin," and he's starting the club. So I read about him in the paper, and I jumped on board.
How does that club function then?
So, in regards to kind of our planning or what do we do, kind of thing?
Right.
Okay. So, what makes it really cool is, just as Bitcoin is, it shows how flat the world is and how people are, collaborating online and through digital channels. So a lot of the work we do is, all digital chat rooms and such. The actual work we aim towards is a lot of research initiatives and also merchant adoption, getting on-campus merchants to start accepting Bitcoin, and then getting students to start, holding Bitcoin, and then seeing the ecosystem grow like that.
What sorts of on-campus merchants are you guys hoping to get on board with this?
So the long run, obviously tuition would be great. People can start paying, for tuition in Bitcoin. But short term, any boutique merchants from, coffee shops, and then all the way up to the bookstore. We have a slight dialogue going on with the bookstore right now, and then other payment processing firms. But yeah.
So the response from the merchants has been good, you'd say?
Nobody started adopting yet. So in that sense, we still have lots of work to do. But in regards to them giving us the time of day where it's not necessarily a priority for them, then yeah, it has been positive.
And how about from the students? What has the response been like from them?
Again, we had a great event. I think we had around 50 new bodies out. So that, that's always good to have people come out on a busy Tuesday evening and learn about Bitcoin. And they were, an educated audience base. They were asking really insightful questions. And then in regards to how the club's grown and their members, it's been great. We started with 10 members, just because that's what the AMS requires. And then after that, just things grew and PR was good. And we're at, I'd like to say 40 to 50 members that are on the email chain.
Should students be considering Bitcoin as a lucrative investment, especially considering how much that currency fluctuates?
I think, yeah, definitely. One of the big highlights of this event we had from Manny Egar, one of our speakers, was that right now you can't be concerned about the dollar value given to it. When you look at the market, potential, it could go big. It may level out and just be a viable currency. There's just so much speculation in it right now. Right now, especially on campus, early days, we're trying to focus on education. So we're trying to get the word out there, hold these events, hold meetups, bring people together, and just get everybody on campus on board. And then, people can decide whether or not they want to really push it, because we just want to raise awareness about it and educate people. So I think in the future, yes, it definitely will be a viable currency.
And just to kind of round things off, I just wanted to ask, where do you hope to see the UBC Bitcoin Club in the future?
The club, I mean, it's just going to take, it's just going to take time for our initiatives to actually come into play and be something tangible. Just bigger and bigger, more collaboration, more sponsorship. Again, having the, 5 years, 10 years down the road, having the university accept Bitcoin as tuition, if we can put the club's name on that, that'd be huge. But just having maybe, a Bitcoin 101 class integrated into some faculty in the future would be great, just so students are actually learning about this before they go off.
Perfect. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
That was Wilson Cross and Ben Tedamonte from the UBC Bitcoin Club. You can find out more about their initiative at ubcbitcoin.ca or on their Facebook page at facebook.com/ubcbitcoinclub or tweet at them at ubcbitcoin.
Thank you, Costa. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Sausage, pork, beef, cheese, whole milk, butter, margarine, nuts, and sausage, pork, beef, cheese, whole milk, butter, margarine, nuts, and sausage, pork, beef, cheese, whole milk, butter, margarine, nuts, and sausage, pork, beef, cheese, whole milk,
Press 1 if you are tripping balls. Press 2 if you are planning to trip balls. Press 3, if all the balls have been tripped, yet you find yourself adrift amongst the tubes of the ether, dreaming of tubes amongst spheres that have not yet been you. Pressed 1, you are tripping balls.
Relax. You're not tripping balls. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
That's our program for today, January 30th. Today's newscast is brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Alberto Montilla.
And I'm Jennifer Schrimmer. Today's broadcast was produced by Emily Blake. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM. To close off the show, we have the number one album on our charts this week, Bonnie State of Mind. This is Comfortable Conversation by Freak Heat Waves.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
There are two things I will carry in my pockets at the end.